Chapter 16. His confidence in his ability to perform as a detective growing, Decker spent another hour going over and over the preliminary shot registry. It was based on witness accounts, which Decker knew were unreliable, forensic evidence, which he knew was not nearly as flawless as TV made it seem, hunches, which were just that, and nothing more, and lastly, common sense, which might just be the most accurate and helpful of the bunch. Lancaster looked away from her laptop screen and studied him.
So what do you think?
Decker absently stroked his shortened beard, his belly rumbling. It was now light outside, and it had been a long time in between meals for him. But he could stand to miss a few meals, a few hundred of them, in fact. He was like a polar bear. He could live off his accumulated fat all winter.
Point one. I think he originated from the cafeteria.
Okay.
Point two. I think Debbie Watson was the first Vic.
So we're back to your dilemma. 1 + 1 = 3. How did a big guy in camis, hood, and face shield walk the length of the school with weapons, totally unseen? And then where did he go? He can't just vanish.
There's no way there could be two shooters, he said. One coming out of the freezer, and one coming in the rear. She shook her head.
Impossible. There was only one shooter, same description. Unless you think identically shaped men did this together.
Okay, one shooter. The pistol is easily hidden. The shotgun could be stowed down a pant's leg.
But the clothing, the shield?
Decker thought some more about this. Who's to say he put that on in the cafeteria?
We found a fiber in the ceiling.
Still doesn't mean he had all the stuff on in there.
So he carries it down the hall with him? In what? And the guns? The guy must have been so bulky that someone would have noticed, especially if he was a stranger. And then where does he change?
You're sure no one was seen walking the halls at that time?
Yes.
No one, really. In a busy school?
Everyone was in class, both students and teachers. The folks in the office were working. Most had not been at their desks long. The gym teacher was in his office where he was shot. There was a half-eaten egg McMuffin on his desk and a nearly full cup of coffee. Custodians were in their part of the school, going over the schedule for the day.
But if no one was in the halls, there was no one to see a stranger roaming. But then Decker immediately corrected himself. Only all the doors have windows. He would have had to pass by numerous ones.
Exactly.
Agreed Lancaster. No visitors?
None logged in, and no one remembered any. That's not to say someone didn't slip in. That's always possible. And like you said, he could have come in the night before during the play. The school was wide open then.
But why would the guy hide in the freezer? Said Decker. Is there security here at night? Lancaster shook her head.
No, but if he came in during the school play, he would want to be out of sight. He couldn't know someone wouldn't come into the cafeteria that night for some reason.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's move to Debbie Watson. She was heading to the nurse's station? Lancaster nodded.
Yes, she had stopped, apparently, to get something from her locker. It was right near where she was found. The locker door was still open.
And the nurse's room is in the office section. Lancaster nodded again.
She would have had to walk along the main corridor from the rear to the front.
What class was she coming out of to go to the nurse?
Math, classroom 144.
Same hall as custodial.
That's right,
said Lancaster.
Which has a loading dock and thus an exit.
So, if we're right, and the guy came through the cafeteria, here's what his route looks like. He went from the front to the back of the school on the first floor. I'm assuming the second and third floors were clear.
We're searching them, of course, but the enrollment at Mansfield has steadily gone down over the years. There are enough kids to fill out the first floor, and that's it. They have a hard enough time finding bodies to fill out the football team. The upper floors are used for storage and such, and they're locked and barred off, and they were still secure when we checked them, with no sign of tampering.
Now, for some reason, he waited to start shooting until he got to the rear of the school. Then he starts popping people, going down halls, entering classrooms, shooting as he goes. He reaches the office at the front, kills the assistant principal, and then he escapes through the cafeteria's loading dock and takes the footpath to the woods. How likely is that?
You mean, why didn't he just start shooting in the front, work his way to the back, and then escape out the rear?
Decker was studying the ceiling. Let's put means aside and look at motive. Mansfield has its share of violence, gangs, drugs, assaults. Kids mature a lot faster.
No argument there.
So is this a Columbine? A kid with a grudge? Maybe not even a student. Either from another school, or he graduated, or he dropped out.
We're compiling a database with all that info. The FBI is helping.
When will they have an answer? Lancaster rubbed her eyes and checked her watch.
I'm not sure. Look, I've got to get home, grab an hour of sleep, and change my clothes. And I need to give Earl a little break. Sandy hasn't been sleeping very well lately.
Decker knew Sandy Lancaster as gentle, funny, bubbly, and wildly enthusiastic about everything and everyone. But he knew she could also become depressed and anxious over something relatively trivial. And then she wouldn't sleep, which meant no one else in the Lancaster household did either. "You need any help with that?" asked Decker. She looked surprised.
"Are you offering to babysit?"
"I don't know. I'm just asking." He finished awkwardly. He had never done much with Molly, when she had been really little. He was so big and she was so tiny, he had been terrified he'd break her. Lancaster smiled.
"I'm good, Amos, but thanks. I'll be back at the station later this morning. We can grab a cup of coffee and go over things. You need a ride back to your place?"
"No, I'll hang out here for a while."
"Suit yourself. You want to talk? About anything, give me a ring."
She gathered up her things and started to leave, but she stopped and looked at him.
"It really feels like old times."
Decker said nothing, but he gave her a slight nod, which made her smile. She turned and walked out.
He sat in the chair in the library. He spent more time in here now than he probably had in his 4 years as a student.
It wasn't that the schoolwork had come easily to him, it hadn't. But he was not the type to sit and read. That had changed. Now he devoured prodigious amounts of information. Now that he could remember it all, it was like he couldn't get enough of it. He wondered if his brain had a capacity limit. If so, he hoped it was as big as he was. He watched the FBI suits doing their thing at a table across the library's main area. They all looked clean-cut, on the younger side, inexhaustibly professional, starched shirts, ties no doubt as straight as their spines. A few of them looked up occasionally at him, no doubt wondering what a fat weirdo dressed like a homeless person was doing in the middle of their investigation. "Well, at least I trimmed my beard and cut my hair. Or else they'd probably arrest me for looking like a big-ass version of Charlie Manson." And then the next moment he forgot all about the FBI. He was really no longer in the library at Mansfield. He was no longer looking into the mass shooting here. It was something Lancaster had said. "I'll be back at the station later this morning. We can grab a cup of coffee and go over things."
Decker would not be at the station later this morning. He had somewhere else to be. "I'll be at an arraignment."
Sebastian Leopold took solid form in Decker's thoughts. He went back over every second of their conversation, every word, every look, every mannerism. Something seemed off, but he couldn't pinpoint what, when he almost always could. Orphan facts, he liked to call them. There was no one to claim ownership because they were lies. Yet not with Leopold for some reason. And that was cause for concern, but also hope. The reason for hope? Simply Leopold's existence. Before, Decker had nothing to go on. Now, in the form of the prisoner, he had a layer that had been partially peeled back. And when that happened, it couldn't help but reveal what was underneath. He left the library and made his way outside. It was still raining. If anything, it was raining harder. The body bag wagons had all gone, and with them the crowd had drained away. No more cell phone candles. But in front of the school was a mountain of flowers, hand-painted signs, teddy bears, all drenched and soggy. But the intent was still clear, still powerful.
He read some of the signs.
R.I.P., Mr. Kramer. Miss you, Debbie. Never going to forget you, Eddie. The town knew who the dead were for a very simple reason, though no names had been officially released. Those people hadn't come home. Cammy Man had seen to that. Cammy Man with no face and the ability to leap long school halls effortlessly. Because that's what he must have done to get from point A to the kill zone with Miss You Debbie. Decker went back to the bleachers and sat there under an overhang to keep dry, though he was pretty much already soaked. Sebastian Leopold was going to be arraigned in a few hours. Decker planned to be there when he was. Arraignments were typically boring, mechanical stages of the law. Yet there was one important bit of information Decker wanted to see in person. He sat there for a few minutes more. Then, when the rain slowed, he rose and walked back to the Residence Inn.
It took him a while, because he didn't move as swiftly as he used to. But it gave him time to think, and he arrived in time for breakfast.
He absorbed half the buffet, catnapped for exactly 1 hour, showered, combed his hair, put his lawyer clothes back on, and headed to the courthouse to see exactly what Sebastian Leopold was going to say to the most critical question the judge would ask him today. Chapter 17. Normally the courthouse would be packed for something like this. A triple homicide and a guy saying he was good for it. 2 days ago, it would have been the biggest story in Burlington, maybe the whole state. But after the slaughter at Mansfield, nobody gave a damn. Well, one person did. Decker knew the drill. Having testified in the court building countless times during the course of prosecuting folks he'd helped apprehend, he passed through security, nodded to a couple of county sheriffs he knew, and checked the court docket posted on a board near the information desk. Then he headed to the courtroom, where in about 20 minutes, Sebastian Leopold would make his first court appearance after walking into the police station and giving himself up. Decker swung open the heavy oak door and took a seat in the middle of the large room. He was the only one there. No bailiff, no court reporter, no lawyers. The press was covering Mansfield, he reckoned. Part of him would have preferred to be at Mansfield, too. But the most important part of him wanted to be right where he was.
A minute later, the prosecuting attorney, a woman in her 40s, came into the courtroom, passed by Decker, and took her seat at the counsel table.
Decker knew Sheila Lynch, but she had not made eye contact. She opened her briefcase, took out a file, and read through it. Decker stared at the back of her neck, which was exposed because her hair was up in a tight, professional bun. Lynch's skirt and jacket were black and already showing traces of grime.
The back of her right shoe had a gouge out of it, and her nylons were a bit ragged where the shoe met the stocking.
At 9:55, the same door Decker had passed through opened again. He glanced back. Lancaster gave him a tiny wave. Behind her was Captain Miller. He was in uniform today. They took seats on either side of him. Lancaster said,
"Don't know what I was thinking about when I said I'd meet you at the station. Of course you'd be here."
"Why aren't you at Mansfield?" Decker asked. Miller answered, "I have been. Since 6:30 this morning. Now we're here. After this, Lancaster is heading there while I go sit my fat ass behind my desk and deal with crap I don't want to deal with."
"Doesn't answer why you're here," said Decker.
"No, I guess it doesn't." Decker continued to eyeball Miller. "I don't have a gun. I passed through the magnos at the entrance. I can't shoot the guy."
"Never doubted that for an instant," said Miller, smoothing out a wrinkle on his dark blue jacket. "But this is an important case. And so here we are. Were you able to trace Leopold's real identity? Was he in the Navy? We sent his prints through the FBI's IAFIS database. No hits. Decker said, he told me he was in the Navy. He had the tat. But maybe he wasn't in our Navy. Foreigner? Said Miller in a thoughtful tone. That might explain it.
Do you think Sebastian Leopold is his real name?
Asked Lancaster. I didn't, answered Decker. But I'm not sure now. Well, we can have the Bureau make international inquiries for us, said Miller. They can go through overseas databases a lot easier than we can. At the stroke of 10, the rear door leading into the judge's chambers opened, and the bailiff, a portly man with a handlebar mustache, stepped through. He told them to rise, and all four of them did. Decker heard the door creak open and turned to see a young woman dash in and take a seat at the rear. She held a notepad in one hand and a tiny digital recorder in the other. The press. All one of them. She must be very junior, thought Decker, or else she would be overcovering Mansfield. His brain dug into the big pile of stuff inside his head and pulled out the name. Alex Jameson. The woman who'd called him about Leopold. She worked for the news leader. He'd hung up on her. He turned back around before she could focus on him. It was at this moment that the black-robed judge Christian Abernathy stepped into the courtroom. He was old, bespectacled, and frail, and his white hair, what was left of it, sprouted all over his head like bits of fading cotton, taped to pink wax paper masquerading his skin. The running bet among the police was how long it would be before Abernathy croaked on the bench, toppling over onto the marble floor. Decker remembered that the man never made it easy for the police to convict anyone. But maybe that was as it should be, he thought. Abernathy sat, and so did they. The door to the right opened. The holding cell was kept there, Decker knew. Out stepped Sebastian Leopold in his bright orange jumpsuit, his hands and feet chained, with two burly uniforms on either side of him. He performed the shackle shuffle as he walked. He looked around the large, high-ceilinged courtroom as though he was not fully cognizant of where he was or what he was doing here. He was escorted to the counsel table, although there was no counsel there. Decker leaned in to Miller. P.D.? Miller shook his head and mouthed, "Apparently not." He did not look happy about this. Not happy at all. The uniforms removed the shackles and stepped back. The bailiff rose, picked up a docket sheet, and called the case and read out the charges that Leopold was facing. Then, his duty completed, he stepped back with the mechanical movement of a cuckoo clock figure returning to its hiding place. Abernathy adjusted his glasses and peered down at the prosecuting attorney. "Ms. Lynch?" Lynch rose, adjusted her shirt cuffs, and said,
"Mr. Leopold has been charged with 3 counts of murder in the first, Your Honor. He has no known address, and his ties to the community are apparently non-existent. In light of the serious charges, we request no bail be set and that he be remanded to the county jail until trial."
Well, thought Decker, that was all to be expected. They weren't about to cut the man loose. Abernathy turned to Leopold and peered down at him from his high perch. Then he shot a glance back at Lynch. "Where is Mr. Leopold's counsel, Ms. Lynch?" Lynch cleared her throat and said,
"He was not able to afford counsel, and a public defender was appointed to represent him. However, Mr. Leopold refused those services numerous times, I might add."
Abernathy's gaze swiveled back to the accused. "Mr. Leopold, do you understand the charges that have been read to you?" Leopold looked around as though he was wondering to whom Abernathy was speaking. "Mr. Leopold, do you not want counsel?" asked Abernathy sharply. Leopold turned to face him, shook his head, and said, "I got no money." "That's why we have public defenders, Mr. Leopold," Abernathy said testily. "They're free.
You can thank the Supreme Court's interpretation of our Constitution for that. I will set this arraignment aside for now until one is provided for.
I did it, sir, said Leopold, interrupting.
Abernathy gazed down at him as though the defendant were a mildly interesting bug lying on the sidewalk.
Excuse me? I done it, so I don't need a lawyer. Are you telling me that you're pleading guilty to 3 homicides in the first degree? I killed them. So, yes, sir, I guess I am.
Abernathy took a moment to clean his glasses, as though that would make what was happening a bit clearer. After settling them on his long, crooked nose, he said,
This is hardly the time for guessing, Mr. Leopold. These are serious charges. Indeed, the most serious of all. Are you aware that not only your freedom is at risk here, but also your life? This is a capital case.
You mean a death penalty?
Abernathy looked like he might stroke.
Yes, of course that's what I mean, Mr. Leopold. Well, I'm pleading guilty, 'cause I done it. So I guess we don't need no trial.
Abernathy looked back at Lynch and said in an admonishing tone, Ms. Lynch, I find this reprehensible.
Judge Abernathy, we tried our best. Mr. Leopold refused all entreaties to...
Abernathy looked over Lynch's shoulder and spotted Miller. With a slow wave of his hand, he beckoned the police chief forward.
Shit, muttered Miller.
He stood, passed in front of Decker and Lancaster, and hurried up to the bench along with Lynch.
Decker watched as the police captain, prosecutor, and judge engaged in a heated discussion. Well, actually, Abernathy was doing most of the talking. It seemed the judge was quite animated and gesticulated twice at Leopold.
Miller nodded and said something. Lynch did the same, and they hastily returned to their seats, each looking upset. When Decker looked at him questioningly, Miller shook his head and said, Later. Abernathy said to Leopold,
I'm ordering you to be returned to your cell for now. A public defender will be appointed to represent you. You will then be returned to this court for your arraignment tomorrow morning.
He glanced at Lynch.
And get the psych-eval done promptly, Ms. Lynch. Understood?
She nodded, her gaze refusing to meet his. Abernathy said,
Officers, please. Remove the defendant.
He wrapped his gavel down. The 2 uniforms immediately came forward, shackled a confused-looking Leopold, and led him back out. Abernathy said to the bailiff,
Call the next case, please, and I trust he will have counsel.
As he said this, he shot first Lynch and then Miller a withering look. Decker, Lancaster, and Miller rose and headed out as the second prisoner was led in for his hearing.
The reporter had already left.
Out in the hall, a scowling Lynch came over to Miller. She said,
I don't like getting my ass handed to me in court, Mac.
We couldn't force him to accept a lawyer, Sheila. You were in the middle of it, you know.
Well, he's getting one whether he likes it or not, if only to enter a guilty plea.
She shot Lancaster and then Decker a glance.
Hello, Amos. I guess I'm not surprised to see you here.
I guess not, replied Decker. Lynch turned back to Miller.
Since Abernathy's ordered a psych eval, I'm not sure he'll be able to plead to anything if the eval comes back like I think it might. You mean mentally unfit,
said Lancaster.
You've seen the guy. You think he's all there?
Maybe he was 16 months ago, said Decker.
Doesn't matter if he's not legally competent to stand trial now.
She turned and hurried off, her briefcase banging against her thigh. Decker turned to Miller.
So?
So we got rid of the riot act by Abernathy. He was pissed that Leopold had no PD, and he's right. Death penalty case with no lawyer? Whatever happened at this level would get overturned on appeal automatically. And Abernathy does not like to get overturned by the appellate court. That's why he was ticked off. I think he thought we were setting him up. As if.
So, why wasn't a PD appointed? Asked Decker.
Like Lynch said,
Leopold didn't want one. He was totally uncooperative. Kept saying he did it, so why did he need a lawyer? We had our hands full with Mansfield, or else we would have handled it differently. We basically dropped the ball there.
Decker stuffed his hands into his pockets and let his chin fall to his chest.
So you lawyer him up, he comes back in, pleads guilty, and then what?
Well, hopefully his lawyer will convince him to plead not guilty, just so it looks better. We can talk about a deal and see what comes of it, but we also have to see what the psych eval says. If he's unfit, it throws a monkey wrench into things.
And if he isn't guilty? Asked Decker. Do you think he is? Asked Miller. I met with the guy once. I can't say definitely what I think.
Well, none of this is going to happen today, so we've got time.
Miller glanced at Lancaster.
You better get back to Mansfield. I hear the FBI is working hard to take over the case.
And if they want to, can we really stop them?
Asked Lancaster.
We're not going to roll over and play dead for the feds, Mary, said Miller sternly. He looked at Decker.
You going to be able to continue helping us on it? Leopold will keep this prick at Mansfield. The longer it goes, the harder it'll be for us to find him.
Decker looked off. The answer should have been easy, only it wasn't. Miller studied him for a few moments.
Well, let me know.
He turned and walked off, leaving Lancaster and Decker standing in the hall. Activity in the courthouse had started to heat up, and the corridors were growing full. Moms crying about sons in trouble. Lawyers clustered like chickens in a pen. Cops were coming and going, and folks were wandering around who were already in trouble or about to be. Lancaster said sharply,
Why the wavering? Last night you said the shooter wasn't going to get away with it.
Decker didn't answer right away. He was watching the reporter standing next to the entrance at the courthouse. She was obviously waiting for him.
Amos?
Said Lancaster. He glanced back at his former partner. I'll be at the high school later today.
Does that mean you're still engaged on it?
Later today, said Decker. He headed for the rear exit.
The reporter caught up to him halfway down the hall.
Mr. Decker? Mr. Decker?
Decker's first plan was to just keep walking, but the woman gave every indication that she would simply follow him out of the building, down the street, and into his next life if need be. So he stopped at the exit, turned, and looked down at her. His mind automatically collected observations and distilled them into an assortment of deductions. She was in her late 20s, pretty, tall, slim, and brunette, with her hair cut short around her ears. Ears that weren't pierced even for earrings. He saw tat letters on her left wrist where her cuff rode up. Iron butterfly. Well, they did make a comeback after she was born. Her eyes were a dull blue that clashed with her complexion. One of her incisors was chipped. Her nails were bitten down to the rims. Her right index finger had once been broken and healed badly with a little bend to it in the middle, and her lips were overly thin and chapped. She didn't smell of smoke, drink, or perfume.
Her clothes were not new, nor overly clean, but they rode well on her tall, slender figure.
She had a dark blotch on the inside of her right middle finger where the pen was held. Not just a keyboard clicker in. She used ink. Her face held the wonderful enthusiasm of youth, as yet unblemished by life. That age was a nice time in anyone's life, and it was necessary to get through what was coming in later years. If we all started out cynical, what a shitty world that would be.
Mr. Decker, I'm Alex Jameson with the news leader.
You like Inagata De Vita? It was Butterfly's biggest seller, 30 million and still counting, in the top 40 of all time. Decker had read this in a Rolling Stone article 3 years ago while eating a PBJ and drinking a cup of coffee at a diner downtown while he was a witness in a case involving a burglary ring he and Lancaster had busted. It was on page 42 of the magazine, lower right-hand corner. He could see the page and the accompanying picture in his head so clearly. It was like he was watching high-def TV. At first, this total recall had scared the crap out of him. Now, it was as natural to him as swallowing. She seemed surprised by this until she glanced down at her tat. She looked back at him, smiling.
My mom got me into their early music. Then when the band reformed, the last time I became sort of obsessed. I mean, they played with Jimmy Page and Zeppelin. A lot of tragic stuff with them, though.
Decker did not follow this up with anything, because music was not why she was here, and he had places to be. She seemed to get this point by his silence.
I tried calling you. I don't like to chase people down in the courthouse.
She said a bit defensively. Decker just kept staring at her. All around them, the courthouse activity went on, bees in a hive, oblivious to the pair of intruders into their world of legal higgledy-piggledy.
Sebastian Leopold didn't have counsel.
That's right, said Decker, but he will.
What do you think about all this?
She held up her recorder.
You mind?
I don't have anything to say.
I'm sure you're going through hell right now. I mean, this guy just pops up out of nowhere and confesses. You must be reeling.
I don't reel, said Decker. He turned to leave.
But you must be feeling something. And how was it facing Leopold in there? It must have brought everything back to you.
Decker faced her. It didn't bring everything back to me. She looked stunned.
But I thought...
Because it never left me. Now I have some place to be. Decker walked out of the courthouse, and Jameson did not follow him.
Chapter 18. Decker caught a bus a block over from the courthouse and rode it to within a half mile of where he was going. As his large feet carried him down the sidewalk, the color blue intensified in his head until it seemed that the entire world had been covered in it. Even the sun seemed to have been transformed into an enormous blueberry so utterly swollen that it seemed it might burst at any moment. It sickened him, but he kept on going, his breath growing heavier and his tread slowing. He was out of shape, but that was not the reason. The reason was just up ahead. When he turned the corner and saw the house, he stopped, but only for a moment. If he didn't pick up his pace, he knew he would turn and run away. It was still bank-owned. No one had wanted to move in there, even at a reduced price. Hell, they probably couldn't give it away. And there were lots of empty houses in Burlington. It was a place one wanted to get away from, not move to. The front door, he knew, was locked. The door off the carport and into the kitchen had always been easy to Jimmy. He wondered if the killer had gone in that way. Leopold had said that was his ingress, if he was to be believed. He passed by the front and opened the chain-link gate to the backyard. The color blue had initially been limited to the bodies. Now the entire property and everything within a half mile of it was blue. He had first experienced this the third time he had returned to the house, and it had been that way ever since. He could never adequately explain to anyone what it felt like to see blue grass, blue trees, blue siding on a house you knew was painted yellow. Even the blue sky felt different because all the clouds were also that color. He eyed the tree in the back and the swing dangling from it. He'd put that up himself because Molly had wanted one. When she was little, Decker would push her. Sometimes he had pushed Cassie and Molly together. It had been cheap entertainment for a young couple with little money. Now the rope was rotted, and the long plank of wood Decker had fashioned for a seat was warped and splintered. The bank was having someone cut the grass, but it was full of weeds. He turned to look at the rear of the house. The back door led into a small utility room. Had that actually been how the killer had entered? He jimmied this door easily enough. It seemed none of the locks on the house worked very well, something that, again, caused him enormous guilt. A policeman who couldn't even secure his own house. He closed the door behind him and looked around. Short flight of steps up to the kitchen. where his brother-in-law had sat drinking beer until someone had sliced his neck from ear to ear. He went up the blue steps and stepped into the blue kitchen. It was full of dust, and some dead insects were on the floor and on the countertops. He eyed the spot where the kitchen table had been. That's where Johnny Sachs had been attacked. The blood had long since been cleaned up, but Decker remembered where every drop had been. Not red now, all blue, like the color of blood as seen inside veins through one's skin, only 1,000 times more potent. He passed into the next room and up the stairs, the same stairs he had taken 3 at a time on that night, bouncing off walls, oblivious to whoever might have been in here harming his family. The mattress and box springs were gone from their bedroom. Evidence. They were at a secure storage unit maintained by the Burlington police. They might be there forever. Still, he clearly saw her bare foot raised up above the bed. He crossed the room and looked down and saw neon blue Cassie on the floor. The only thing that wasn't blue about her was the single gunshot wound to her head. Even in Decker's altered mind, it would forever be just like it actually was, black and blistered. He turned and left because his resistance was wearing down, and he had other rooms to visit. He opened the bathroom door and looked at the toilet where his child had been seated, the bathrobe cord cruelly holding her dead body in place. Leopold had not explained that. He had just done it. Didn't really know why. Felt right, he said. The man no one could identify. The man who wanted to plead guilty and die. He looked down at the spot where he had sat cross-legged with the gun first inside his mouth and then pressed against his temple. His dead daughter in front of him. He had wanted to join her, he guessed, in death. But he hadn't pulled the trigger. The cops had come and recognized him and talked him out of the weapon. It was a wonder they hadn't shot him. Maybe it would have been better if they had. He turned and walked back down the hall to the next door. Molly's room. He had only been here a few times since cleaning it out after her death. The noise from inside caused him to stop, his hand halfway to the knob. He looked around. He had left his gun back in his room because he knew he had been going to the courthouse. He listened some more, and then his tension eased. It was not human feet he was hearing. Scampering, tapping, tiny. He opened the door in time to see a rat disappear into a hole in the drywall. He could recall every stick of furniture, the placement of every stuffed animal, the location of each book, for Molly had been a voracious reader. Decker had been about to fully enter the room when he stopped and stiffened. There was something here that his perfect memory did not recall, and with good reason, because it had not been here the last time Decker had been in this room. On the wall, written in red block letters, "We are so much alike, Amos, so much, like brothers. Do you have a brother? Of course you don't. I checked. Sisters, yes, but no brother. So can I be yours? We're really all the other has now. We need each other." He read through this message 3 times. He wanted to dig beneath the words and discover the author. But the more he stared at the words, the more unsettled he became. The person had come back here, to write this message to him. This was not about some perceived slight at a 7-Eleven. This was deeply personal with Decker. As the message had said, Decker had no brother. He had 2 sisters, long since moved away. One in California with her army husband and 4 kids. The other was in Alaska, childless but prospering and enjoying life with her oil executive husband. They had come for the funerals and then had gone back home. He had not spoken to them since. His fault. They had tried repeatedly. He had rebuffed. Repeatedly. But still, he had to make sure. Whoever had written this message had done his homework. sisters. He slowly pulled his phone from his pocket and texted each of them. He waited, waited, waited. Then a pop on his phone. California sister was fine and happy to hear from him. 2 minutes later, he hadn't moved. It was even earlier in Alaska. Maybe she wasn't up. Another pop. His sister from Fairbanks had texted. She was fine. To please call when he got a chance. He punched in another number and waited for the person to answer.
Lancaster,
the voice said. Decker said, Mary, you need to see something, and you need to see it now. Chapter 19. Lancaster had come, then Captain Miller, then the uniforms, then the forensics team with all its bags of gadgets. It was like that night all over again, only he wasn't staring at his dead daughter while holding a gun against his head. The message had been written with a red Sharpie. The ink dried almost immediately, and there was no telling how long it had been there. Thus, Leopold was not in the clear. He had only been locked up since very early yesterday morning. Miller had wanted to know how the killer would have known Decker would come back here, enter this room, and see this message. I've been back here before, admitted Decker.
And you went inside each time?
Said Lancaster. Not every time. No, I couldn't. Every time.
When was the last time you were in this room?
Asked Lancaster. 4 weeks and 3 days ago. Right about this time.
So at least we have a time window to work with.
Noted Lancaster. Maybe this guy has been following you and knows you come here, said Miller. That's why I put this message up.
We can canvass the neighborhood, see if anyone saw something.
They didn't see who murdered three people, countered Decker. I don't see why they would have seen the person who did this. But still, replied Miller, we're going to do it.
Brothers?
Said Lancaster curiously, as the police photographer took shots of the message.
We might want to get a shrink in on this to analyze what's going on inside the dude's head.
So you think this is Leopold's work? Asked Miller. He was staring at the graffiti like it was part of an inscription on the doorway to hell. Decker said nothing, because he had nothing to say. In his head, the words were indeed a flaming red, thus not so far away from hell. Whoever had written this was either being straightforward, at least in a deranged way, or else he was playing head games with him. Decker turned and left, ignoring Lancaster's calling after him. He never saw Miller grab Lancaster by the arm. He didn't hear his old captain tell her to let him be. He didn't hear Lancaster's retort, and then Miller's request sharpened to a direct order for her to stand down. They both watched him from the window striding down the sidewalk with a purpose. He soon turned the corner and was gone from their sight. Decker didn't stop walking until he reached the 7-Eleven on DeSalle at 14th. This marked the first time in his life he had not traveled there by car. There were no cars parked in front. He opened the door, heard the bell tinkle, and then let it close behind him. There was a woman behind the counter. She was short but looked taller because of the elevated floor there. Her hair was dark and straight, falling to her shoulders. She looked Latina. She had on a beige long-sleeved blouse with a bra strap showing on one side. She was around 50, and her eye sockets were starting to recede into her face like a pond starting to dry up. A large dark mole was on her left cheek. She had some sheets of paper in front of her and was studying them and then counting off packs of cigarettes shelved in slots overhead. A man appeared from down one aisle. He had a mop in hand and was using it to stir a bucket with soapy water in it. Decker ran his gaze over him, his police training guiding his eye to certain vital statistics. He was white, mid-30s, an inch under 6 feet, very lean and wiry, with narrow shoulders. His short-sleeved shirt showed off the veins in his arms. His hair was brown and curly and fell like apple peelings across his head. The woman looked up at him just standing there in the doorway.
Can I help you?
She asked. She had no accent. He came forward and took his phone from his pocket. He hit a couple buttons and held it up. You ever see this guy before? She looked at the photo of Sebastian Leopold.
Who is he?
She asked. Some guy that either might have worked here once or hung around here at some point. She shook her head.
I don't remember seeing him. Why you want to know?
Decker fished out his PI license and flashed it in front of her. I'm trying to find him. He might be due some money. Got a line on him that brought me here. How about your friend over there? He quickly looked at the man who was leaning on his mop and studying him quizzically. The woman said,
Billy, you want to look at this picture?
Billy parked his mop and bucket against a rack of candy bars, wiped his hands on his faded jeans, and ambled over. He looked pleased to have an excuse to stop cleaning the linoleum. He looked at the photo and then shook his head. Nope. Don't look familiar to me. Weird-looking dude. Spacey. Decker lowered the phone. How long have you two been here? The woman said,
Nearly 6 months for me. Billy came just a few weeks ago.
Decker nodded. Too recent, then. And the people here before you? She shrugged.
I don't know. There was a woman, a couple of men. Turnover is high here. The pay is not very good. And the hours are long. I wouldn't be here if I could find something better. But the job market sucks.
She added bluntly. Decker looked at Billy. You? Billy grinned. I don't know nothing about this place. Just drawing a paycheck, man. Beer money on the weekends. Looking to have a good time with the ladies. Need cash for all that. He went back to his mopping.
I'm sorry we can't help you,
said the woman. Part of the job, said Decker. Thanks. He turned and left. His phone buzzed. He looked at it. Lancaster. He put it away without answering. It rang again. He looked at it again. Lancaster. He sighed and hit the answer button. Yeah?
Amos?
Decker immediately went rigid. Lancaster sounded nearly hysterical, and she wasn't the type ever to do so. Mary, what is it? Not another shooting. Decker had been worried about this from the start. Things about the attack at Mansfield had made him believe that the guy was...
No.
She said breathlessly.
But there's something...
Where are you? He interrupted.
At Mansfield.
So it has to do with Mansfield? You found some...
Amos!
She shrieked.
Just let me finish.
Decker fell silent, waited. It was as though he could hear her heart beating from across the digital ether.
We ran ballistics on the pistol used at Mansfield.
And what did... Interrupting, she said.
And we found a match.
His grip tightened around the phone. A match? To what?
To the gun that killed your wife.
Chapter 20. A .45 caliber round, semi-jacketed, hollow-pointed. An SJH in ballistic shorthand. It was a brutally efficient piece of ordnance, not exactly a dum-dum, named after Dum-Dum, India, where a British Army officer had invented a bullet that mushroomed out on impact and acted as a miniature wrecking ball inside the body. Innovation wasn't always good for you. The .45 caliber SJH had blown right through the front of Cassie Deckard's skull and ended up lodged deep in her brain. It had been dug out of her during the autopsy, and the slug preserved as evidence in her murder investigation. It had retained enough of its shape and lands and grooves to one day be matched to the weapon that had fired it. Well, they didn't have the weapon, but they had something else. Now they knew that the very same pistol that had fired the bullet ending Cassie Decker's life had also terminated the lives of half the victims at Mansfield. The other half had endured the blunt force of the shotgun. The medical examiner had removed the matched round from Kramer, the gym teacher, and, per normal protocol, run it through the department's database. The hit had been immediate. Because of the magnitude of the finding, the FBI had run its own tests on the slug and came back with the same conclusion. Same gun. Ballistics didn't lie. The grooves and lands on the bullet's respective hides had matched like a fingerprint. And that wasn't all. They had recovered the single bullet casing from the Decker's bedroom. They had compared it with several of the casings found at the school. The pinprick on the bottom of the casing where the firing pins strike was nearly as good as a fingerprint. And it, too, had matched on all salient points. The murders of Decker's family and the massacre at Mansfield were now inextricably connected. Decker huddled in his coat as he stood outside the darkened facade of the school, enduring the driving rain pinging off his hair and burly shoulders. The case had mushroomed from Mansfield High to his home on a quiet street with symbolically an ocean's distance in between. He had never given any thought to a connection between the two crimes. Now, that fact dominated him. There was a chance that there were different killers. Since the shooting at his house, the gun could have been lost by, taken from, or sold by the original killer. The same gun was often used in different crimes by different perps, but Decker believed it was the same shooter in both instances. And if that was the case, it let Leopold out. So Leopold was lying. Yet it was possible he had been told facts of the Decker case by the real killer. And if that were so, then Leopold was the best hope he had to find the person who had murdered his family, and all these others. Despite the recent writing on the bedroom wall, the case was cold on the Decker family end. Conversely, it was red hot on the Mansfield High School end. So the Mansfield end was where he would focus, that and on Sebastian Leopold. If Leopold knew who the Decker killer was, then he knew who was behind the Mansfield crimes, too. He flashed his credentials at the perimeter security and walked through the front entrance. Yesterday had been disjointed and confusing for him in all respects. He didn't know if he belonged in the middle of all this. He felt cut off from everyone and everything going on around him. But with the possible connection to the murders of his family, Decker knew that he did belong. He would be on this case for as long as it took. They would have to dynamite him out of here. He didn't head to the command center in the library. He went to the cafeteria and stared at the freezer. Then he looked at the ceiling tiles. Cami fiber. Possible gun oil. Maybe all bullshit. Maybe. He looked at the exit door. False lead, too. Or so now he believed. He left the cafeteria, walked down the hall fronting the library, turned right onto the main corridor that bisected the first floor, and counted his steps off as he made his way to the rear of the school. At each intersection with another hall, he studied the lay of the land, first left, then right. Classrooms on both sides. The last corridor was where Debbie Watson had died. And where to the left, so had Kramer, the gym teacher, over his breakfast sandwich and coffee. The rear entrance with the camera faced him. The angle of the camera still intrigued him. That had been deliberate. And deliberate action always had a deliberate motivation. Then he looked at the classroom to the right of where Debbie had perished. Room 141 was stenciled on the glass. He tried the door, but it was locked. He pulled a pick set from his pocket and unlocked it. He stepped inside and turned on the light. He was surprised to see that it was set up as a shop class. They had shop class back when Decker attended here, but he had thought it now a thing of the past. He looked around at the workplaces. Table and miter saws. Planers, drills, buckets of tools. Vises clamped to wood. Shelves on the walls, holding metal tubing. Nuts, bolts, wood, more power tools, extension cords, work lights, pretty much anything someone would need to build something. There were three doors at the back of this room, He opened two of them. Storage. He saw stacks of what looked to be old-school projects, jumbles of half-finished furniture, metal twisted into various shapes, wire cages, part of a roof section, sawhorses, plywood sheets, stacks of wood, lots of dust, and lots of nothing. The last door would not open. He took out his lockpick set again and used it to open the door. He peered in. There was an old boiler in the far corner, now connected to nothing. Some window air conditioning units were stacked on the floor against one wall up to about 10 feet. Again, a lot of nothing. He closed the door, walked back through the shop class, snapped off the light, and shut the door behind him. Down the hall from the shop class was classroom 144, the one Debbie Watson had been coming from when she had been shot. Decker looked over at the open locker on the wall. That was Debbie's. She had been at her locker when she'd been murdered, probably getting something to take with her to the nurse's office. That might explain the detour here. Or it might not. Teenagers were unpredictable. They could be sick as dogs and stop at their locker to look for some gum. Or examine her face for zits in the mirror that hung on the inside of Debbie's locker. He noted the tube of pimple cream standing up on her locker shelf next to a small open pack of breath mints. Blood splatters showed that she had been standing in front of her locker when she'd been shot. She had turned around to face her assailant because she'd taken the blast from the shotgun directly to her face. She had died at 8:42. Decker had concluded that Watson was indeed the first victim, which made him wonder what the shooter was doing between the whooshing sound at 7:28 on the front hall that Melissa Dalton had heard and Debbie losing her face on the rear hall 1 hour and 14 minutes later. Decker closed his eyes and thought this through. It took me 64 steps and not even 2 minutes to go from front to back. The shooter appeared on the video at 8:41. But when did he leave the cafeteria? There is no way to be sure. And the biggest question of all, how did he go sight unseen from front to rear? I answer that, I answer everything. I don't answer it. The case goes nowhere. At least 6'2", thick broad shoulders, over 200 pounds, Decker had looked at the footage of the shooter and did not dispute those physical estimates. Yet there was no male of that size and height at the school, other than the dead gym teacher and assistant principal, or a bunch of football-playing students hunkered in classrooms with 100 alibis attached to them. And two of the players who were that size had been killed during the shootings. It was as though the guy had appeared, done his killing, and then vanished into thin air. Since that was not a possibility, Decker had to be looking at this wrong somehow. He went into room 144 and sat down at the teacher's desk. He surveyed the classroom. 21 empty seats arranged in 3 rows, front to back. One of them had been occupied by Debbie Watson. The last moments of her life were clear enough. An upset stomach, a trip to the nurse's office authorized, a detour to her locker, and she was dead minutes later. She'd been in the 3rd row, 4th seat. He imagined her raising her hand, looking and feeling ill, getting permission to leave, walking out the door, never to walk in it again. He rose and walked out the door, stopped and turned. He was facing Debbie's open locker. The mirror on the inside of the door reflected his image back. For some reason, Decker didn't recognize himself. This big, fat, bearded dude, drenched with rain, looking like hell. But then he looked past the reflection and to something else in Debbie's locker. A stack of textbooks and notebooks. Decker looked back at classroom 144, and then at the locker. Life had coincidences. Serendipity abounded. Wrong place, wrong time. It came as the result of 7 billion people jostling each other within the span of a single planet. But there was an unwritten rule in police work. There are no coincidences. All you needed was more in-depth investigation to show that there are no coincidences. He phoned Lancaster. She was in the library. Did you talk to Debbie Watson's parents?
Yes.
Did they mention that she felt ill when she came to school?
No, I asked her that. The mom said she seemed fine. Might have been a bug that came on fast, though.
And what about the teacher, when Watson asked to leave? Decker could hear the woman flipping through her notebook.
She said Debbie looked fine, but then raised her hand, said she felt nauseous, and asked to be excused.
Did she make out a note, or...
They have them pre-printed. The teacher filled in Debbie's name and gave it to her.
So, just 30 seconds from start to finish before Debbie left the room.
I guess about that.
What time did she actually leave the classroom?
The teacher thought maybe a few minutes before, maybe 5 before the shot was heard.
That's a big gap. Her locker is seconds away from her class, and I walked from the front of the school to the back in less than 2 minutes.
Maybe she lingered there for a few minutes. Maybe she thought she was going to throw up and was trying to collect herself. Look, why are we...
I'll explain later. It may be nothing. Decker clicked off and put his phone away. He was just about to have a very radical thought that might potentially crush certain people. He didn't do this lightly. He did this only to get to the truth. The truth was worth everything to him. But he needed something concrete to go on before he could move forward on this. Fate for Debbie was 8:42 outside this door. After that, she would be no more, her life over. How would it run? Debbie raises her hand, gets permission to leave. She exits the class, but doesn't go to the nurse directly. She heads to her locker and opens it. Another minute burned. But Lancaster had said the teacher thought it was several minutes, maybe as many as 5. What had Debbie been doing all that time? Maybe she had been lingering or trying to steady herself, like Lancaster had said. But maybe there was something else. He stared once more at the locker's contents. The bloody notebook and other items that had been on the floor next to Watson's body had been taken by the police along with the remains. But not the stuff in the locker. No, not that. That was all still there. And it was in decent shape, because her body had mostly shielded the contents from the shotgun blast. He grabbed the stack of items, went back to classroom 144, and sat down. He opened the first book and went through it page by page. He went through all the textbooks, looking for marginalia, notes, sketches, anything. He had gone through 3 of her lined notebooks and had reached the 19th page of the 4th when he stopped looking. Debbie had drawn a picture on this page. It was a good sketch, actually. The girl had possessed talent. But Decker was far more focused on the subject of the drawing. It was a man in full camouflage gear with a big heart drawn right next to it. Chapter 21. Decker had showered, changed his clothes, carefully combed his hair, and put on his most professional expression. He believed that the folks sitting opposite him deserved nothing less than that. Debbie Watson's mother and father stared back at him. The dad was a small, mousy man in his mid-40s, with a little scrap of mustache above his thin top lip. He had a stunted right arm, the malformed hand hanging from the elbow. He looked like a freight train was bearing down on him. Debbie's mom was chain-smoking. The ashtray in front of her was filled with butts. Nicotine's ability to rob the blood of oxygen had whittled fine lines prematurely around her mouth and deeply and unflatteringly chiseled a face that had probably not been pretty even in youth. Her forearms were veiny and darkened and spotted, probably from lying out during the summer in the hammock Decker had seen strung between 2 trees in the small side yard. The mom didn't look like she'd seen a freight train. She looked as though someone had sucked her soul out, and the smell of the liquor easily crossed the width of the scarred coffee table set between them. On Decker's right, Lancaster was perched on the couch like a cat on a ledge. Her features were tight and serious and hunkered down, and had been ever since Decker had showed her the drawing of Cammy Man in Debbie's notebook. She occasionally looked lustfully at Beth's cigarette, as if waiting for an invitation to pull out her own smokes. They had not shown the sketch to the FBI or anyone else. They had decided to keep it to themselves for now. Decker had said, and Lancaster had agreed, that before anything was released publicly, they needed to talk to the parents. If the sketch was unconnected to the murders, then they didn't want Debbie's family to suffer unnecessarily. In the world of the 24-hour news cycle, the Watson family would be sliced and diced to such a degree that no matter what exculpatory facts were revealed later, the truth would never be able to rise above the earlier electronic tsunami. Decker had prefaced his questions with a lot of disclaimers. He had waited until the Watsons were fully prepped before showing them the sketch. When their gazes had held on the image, both had recoiled and then stiffened, like they'd been electrocuted. Decker saw them both outlined in creamy white. For him, death was blue, while white represented despair. When he looked at himself in the mirror for a full year after his family's murders, he had figured he was the whitest white man in the whole world.